You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. And welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Professor Carlton Shield, Chief Gover. And today for episode 35, we have Dave Williams, the Nebraska State Archaeologist, who's going to lead us on today's journey through North America's rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. Dave, it is a pleasure to have you on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. This is exciting. This is my first podcast, so I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. We're super happy to have you on. And so today we're going to be talking about Dave's research and what he's done and also his journey to get him back into Great Plains archaeology. And so I first learned when you got the new gig after Rob, who we've also interviewed on this show, you were up in the Dakotas. And prior to that, you were a graduate student at University of Colorado Boulder. I see you wearing your Buff shirt.
That's go right. Buffs. Go Buffs.
And you were studying Oaxacan archaeology under Dr. Yeah. Art Joyce. So like, just lead us through, you went to school in South Dakota, correct? Was it University of South Dakota or South Dakota State?
Yeah, USD up in Vermilion. So they got the archaeology program there, and it was, Augustana has one and it's growing. But at the time, USD's was, you know, really kind of the only sort of comprehensive overview archaeology program. So wanted to stay in state. And so that's, you know, kind of the decision I made to hang out and go to Vermilion. And yeah, getting into Oaxaca, I don't know, it's a weird journey because I started in the plains, like right out of high school and through undergrad. Being from Rapid City, that's where the South Dakota State Archaeology Office is. So I got to know those folks and work with them over summers and stuff. Did my field school with them back in like 2003. And then at USD, I had taken a couple of classes in Mesoamerican archaeology, and I got to go down to the Yucatan one summer for a week or week and a half and see a couple sites there. And it was just like, this is cool. I want to work down here. Like, it's different than anything on the plains, anything I've done. So yeah, it was like, I'm going to start looking for grad programs and see where I can go with Mesoamerican archaeology.
Excellent. And for our listeners, Oaxaca, it's a city in Mexico. It's in one of the southern states of Mexico, and it's on the Pacific side of everything. And it's a pretty arid region, right? Like to the east, like northeast, you get the Yucatan and that area. But in Oaxaca, I understand it's pretty dry and mountainous, correct?
Well, yeah, up around the city, Oaxaca City, it absolutely is. It's the mountains, you know, the big valley of Oaxaca is there where Monte Albán is, the city there right in the middle of the valley. We were also working down on the coast, and that gets, you know, pretty hot and humid down the lower Rio Verde Valley is kind of where the research was taking place, Art's long-term research down there, and then his students and cohort and everything. So we kind of bounced around. We started on the coast, moved up to the highlands. And I mean, it's beautiful. Like it's, you know, in a way, it's kind of like going from the Rocky Mountains and in the Front Range out onto the plains. And there are a lot of similarities geographically, but, you know, being down there is literally a whole different world.
I bet. So what were you studying specifically as part of your master's thesis on Oaxacan archaeology?
Yeah. So I, as an undergrad, got into lithic stone tools. I mean, I think a lot of archaeologists kind of start there. It's, you know, it's cool. It's tangible. Points are neat. And so when I visited CU, I met with both Art and Pace and Sheets, teaching at the time, didn't know who I wanted to work with, didn't know exactly where I wanted to work in Mesoamerica, just, you know, wanted to work down there. And I had applied for some other programs as well, but met with them and talked to Art, and I had mentioned an interest in lithics, and he's like, yeah, I, you know, could use somebody down here. We've got a lot of obsidian and nobody's really looked at it in a comprehensive way. So what my thesis research started as a very comprehensive look at lithics across the lower Rio Verde Valley. And we quickly realized that was going to be a daunting task. because there's a lot of sites, a lot of material coming out of those. So it gradually kind of narrowed down into studying obsidian use and basically the sources that folks were using through time, and also trying to identify some technological changes if I could, which ultimately was able to. And so I think I looked at obsidian from 12 or 15 different sites down there. I can't even remember the total. It was over 5,000 artifacts, blades, cores, flakes, all sorts of debitage, and ended up doing a full analysis of all of those, typological. And then we picked samples from really well-dated contexts from across the early formative all the way through the late post-classic periods. So we wanted to get a little sampling of each of those periods and sent those to be geochemically sourced, and was able to put together a picture of obsidian source use over time that ultimately mirrors broader Mesoamerica, but it's in 200 years or so later, just because of how regionally isolated the Pacific coast is down there and the river valley. So by the time the folks were getting their hands on obsidian and getting it down there, we're seeing those sources show up later than like Mexico City, Teotihuacan, out in the Yucatan, places like that. So it was really kind of interesting to see. It's like the same trends in primary source use, but just a little bit later in time.
Fair enough. Excellent. So upon completion of your MA at the University of Colorado Boulder, what happens next?
Well, grad school, it was interesting. I mean, I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. It was great to go work in Oaxaca. It's great to have that experience. My initial plan was to keep going on. I wanted to get a PhD, wanted to go into academia, and in the course of working on the MA and working down there, decided that academia was not for me. And I had kind of a notion of actually switching back to Plains Archaeology while I was at CU, and I had talked to Doug Bamforth and tossed around ideas of maybe doing a PhD with him on some stuff in the Plains, and ultimately decided, now, you know what, I'm happy with the master's and I'm going to go see what I can find work-wise, and left the academic world and got into CRM work. So right after graduating, having worked on the Plains and really just needing to find work, got lucky enough to find a job with R.C. Goodwin and Associates out of Lawrence, Kansas office. And my wife is from Kansas. We were able to move to north of Topeka, a family property up there, and ended up working CRM across basically the entire Plains from North Dakota down to North Texas and all the way out in the Midwest to Ohio, and doing CRM work for them for a few years, and really kind of cut my teeth in doing Section 106 and compliance work and just getting familiar with infrastructure projects and energy projects, pipelines, wind farms, those sorts of things, doing Section 106 evaluations and, you know, working with SHPOs and doing all that sort of stuff that, you know, a lot of us at some point or another end up doing CRM work. And that's just kind of where I fell and kind of found a comfort there.
Excellent. All right. So you're working at R.C. Goodwin. And then so how did you end up getting back into in the Dakotas after doing CRM?
Yeah, well, I grew up there and I had worked with those folks for a number of years and kept in contact with them. And after about 3 years in Lawrence, well, in Kansas, I got a message from folks up in South Dakota that they had an opening for a senior archaeologist position. Talked to the family and thought, yeah, we spent a few years here in Kansas. Let's go, you know, try to see what South Dakota has to offer, and applied and got a job up there at the research center again, this time managing contract projects. So a lot of work that was done up at the research center is contract archaeology for like the Department of Transportation and other agencies like that. So got to go back home and work at the research center again. And a lot of the same folks were still there. So got to catch up with folks that I'd worked with just as a, you know, a green, fresh out of high school, young archaeologist. But now I got to be their boss lead projects around the state and kind of refine those skills. The things they don't teach you in grad school or undergrad, but, you know, working with budgets and doing scopes of work and those sorts of things that maybe pop up in a class or something, but kind of a whole different world than what we go through in, you know, grad school, undergrad coursework and that sort of thing.
I can completely commiserate with that. Like, I still getting thrust in this position, having to like manage federal contracts. Like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Or a couple folks have been like, hey, we need a report on this. I'm like, I don't know how to write a report. I'll get some templates and do my best. Just like stuff like there's no CRM report writing class in school. And I know that's such a huge, I need one so bad, but cool. So when you're transitioning back, was there like an archaeological site or culture you were excited to get back into? Like, was there something about Great Plains archaeology that you were drawn back to, wishing that maybe you'd be able to work on a site?
I mean, South Dakota in particular is so geographically diverse, and you know, we get the Black Hills and you've got kind of these high plains, buttes and mesa type areas up in the northwest part of the state, and hit the big Missouri River Trench, and eastern South Dakota is a lot like the Midwest, kind of rolling hills and lake country and that sort of thing. And so I was looking forward to, you know, after bouncing around, working in Mexico a couple of summers and then working all over the plains and Midwest, being back in one spot, but it felt like being in a much bigger place because of the geographic diversity. And also with South Dakota, the culture history, going back to, you know, there's some great Paleo-Indian sites there, some really well-studied Paleo-Indian sites. As a fan of lithic stone tools, I was looking forward to getting into those and looking at, you know, some of those assemblages. One of the things I didn't really expect but ended up being a really interesting project that I was able to work on was doing some work on stone circle sites, and hadn't really considered them prior to going back to South Dakota. There's not a lot of stone circles in Nebraska, and in my career, everywhere I've worked, I had never encountered many, but we had the opportunity to work on a National Register multiple property document form and do research and compile a bunch of resources and talk with tribal representatives and, you know, talk to other state archaeology offices and learn about what they were doing with stone circle sites and develop this document to consider eligibility criteria for stone circle sites. And that was fascinating, that just the depth of research that's been done, like in Montana and up in Canada and other places, diving into that and trying to apply it to South Dakota, where we had sites and they had been documented and looked at, but that was about the extent of it. That was a lot of fun to get into and kind of apply the research and the background stuff that we did on that to other types of projects moving forward.
Excellent. Well, on that note, we'll be right back with Dave after these messages. And we're back here on episode 35 with Dave Williams. So coming in as a lithics expert working with Hakka and getting back into the Great Plains and specifically looking at the Dakotas, you know, what kind of stone material, the lithic sources, are most prominent out there at those South Dakota sites?
There's a lot. You know, going to Mexico, there's other types of stuff. There's obviously obsidian is far and away the most prevalent lithic source. But in the assemblages, there's cherts and basalt and, you know, jade, of course, and other things like that, kind of exotic things. But the quantities are so much less. Then you get up into South Dakota, in particular in the broader northern plains, and there's a lot of different local cherts, quartzites, chalcedonies. You got Knife River flint coming down. And one of the things that I really enjoyed getting back to the plains was starting to look at that sort of source distribution a little bit more, and that stemmed from being able to do that as part of my grad work. I had kind of started developing this plan in the back of my head, and I presented it a couple times at local conferences about developing a statewide lithic source context and, you know, doing some sourcing work, and come to find out that a couple of others had been working on that exact thing for several years and compiling information and So the last couple of years that I was up in South Dakota, the state archaeologist at the time, Renee Bowen, she had been working on that kind of project for years. And so I was able to help kind of wrap that thing up, and they were able to put a publication out about South Dakota lithic sources. And it's a, you know, a hefty volume with geological information and photos of all the variation of stone materials and, you know, these different outcrop locations and things like that. But that's, I think that's one of the stark differences between working down in Mesoamerica and working up here is, you know, you can look at, okay, it's obsidian, and you know, if it's green, you know, it's this particular source. If it's this kind of dark gray, it's probably this other source. Beyond that, it gets a little trickier, but up here, you can have tan chert, and it could be from a dozen or more different sources, and trying to pinpoint that is much more difficult. But that's part of the fun challenge, is trying to figure out where folks are getting this material from, and how far away it's coming, and who they might be trading it with, or, you know, if they're stockpiling it somewhere and coming back to grab some blanks and take them with, or stuff like that. It's, I still get a kick out of doing that geochemical analysis and looking at that sort of thing.
Excellent. Yeah. One of the lead archaeologists at RC Goodwood in Lawrence, they did their, was it PhD work or master's work on, like, we have this phenomenal lithic material library, but it's like all in, like, and there's a fantastic Excel spreadsheet, but it is a wall of different rocks in like Tupperware, and we're like looking at on how do we rehouse this thing and like really utilize it, because I don't know anything about lithics, and it's like, this is all just looks the same to me. Like, I can pick out the easy stuff, like Hartville uplift, got it. Edwards, yeah. Plateau, perfect. But like, as you said, like some of those charts which have multiple sources and just different color variations that require a microscope and someone like really understand the grains, it's like, that's just beyond me. So I'm always amazed at lithicists and their ability to like look at rocks and like, oh, I know exactly where that's from. So that's awesome. And so, and what's also kind of like kind of cool about your work is like working in Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, you've like worked that whole Missouri River drainage almost, and being able to work with a lot of those same cultures, like looking at like initial coalescent and initial middle Missouri and how that reflects both in Kansas and Nebraska. On any of the sites that you were doing either CRM for or in the state capacity in South Dakota at the lab, like, were you guys able to work on any of those Plains Village period sites?
A little bit. You know, a lot of the work that we were doing was highway work. So it was, you know, kind of across the developed areas. I mean, there's a lot of rural South Dakota, and so there's a lot of highways that go through the middle of nowhere, but we're within a pretty narrow corridor of those. But we did get the opportunity a handful of times while I was up there to work with different agencies like the Corps of Engineers and the South Dakota Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. And they've got land, well, of course, the Corps of Engineers has, you know, manages lands along the Missouri River, and the Game, Fish, and Parks Department has rec areas and wildlife management areas and things along the river. So working on some of those projects, we were able to get in and do a little bit of investigation at some of those Plains Village sites. And I think I had spent, I don't know, 4 years back up in South Dakota before I saw a piece of pottery at a site doing survey. And that, another stark difference between Aka and South Dakota in particular, just no pottery showing up unless you're at those very specific sites, whereas we were pulling out crates full of pottery down in Oaxaca. But excavation wise, didn't get much opportunity up in South Dakota to do work on those sites, but did, you know, research and some write-ups and, you know, the pedestrian survey and documenting depressions from the lodges and identifying the different ceramics on the surface and stone tools and things like that, and kind of a condition updates and assessment reports for the Corps of Engineers to see what sites that they already knew were there, what the conditions were, if stuff was still around. And then we ended up finding a number of new sites as well, which is always exciting up there because so much work has been done, but then you find a new scatter of pottery or something and, you know, try to figure out what group initial coalescent or initial middle Missouri, or, you know, which group is here and how are they interacting with these other well-known sites. Missouri River Trench. That's a lot of fun to work on.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, like, South Dakota archaeology is just so fascinating, especially that time period of like 1200 to 1500 when those Middle Missouri and coalescent folks, like, there's some crazy stuff happening between those groups, between like totally burnt down towns. Yeah. And it's like not great, really cool archaeology, but in terms of anthropology, like, it's fascinating to look at. And so, you know, how does South Dakota archaeology differ from adjacent areas like Nebraska and North Dakota and Wyoming?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, I have this kind of philosophy of, you know, archaeology is archaeology. You know, there's the lithics, there's the pottery. Like, you go from one state to another, and, you know, we've got these arbitrary modern boundaries on them. So it's really a continuation and a, you know, a spectrum of the same thing. But I think because of the Missouri River, you know, so much of that Smithsonian River Basin survey work was done in South Dakota that it's really kind of foundational for Northern Plains archaeology and the information that came out of it. Those village sites, I mean, I can't count how many times I'm looking up, you know, a Nebraska site and it's got references to the people who are working up in South Dakota on all those river basin surveys in the 40s and 50s and into the 60s even. And just the sheer amount of dirt that they moved and the number of sites that they were working on, it's crazy. I think that river work has probably arguably defined South Dakota archaeology when there is a lot more stuff. You've got the Black Hills and there's a real deep history there. There's great Paleo-Indian sites right on the boundary of the Black Hills, the Jim Pitt site kind of down in the Southwest Hills. And I got to work on the Sewerite site, which is on the kind of southeast periphery of the hills, which has a Goshen component, Folsom component, and all the way to late prehistoric. And so I think some of that stuff kind of gets maybe overshadowed a bit by the river basin stuff. And even, you know, the military history for everything that was, you know, the Custer Trail that runs through the northern part of South Dakota gets a lot of attention, but, you know, other sites of that period probably get less attention because of that. There's great mining archaeology. You know, the Black Hills, of course, with the gold rush and all the problems there. There are a ton of mines. The Black Hills, if you look at a site scatter plot of South Dakota where every single site's been mapped, it's like the Black Hills is just a mass. You can't really separate out individual site boundaries from a distance because there's so much going on, camps and mines and CCC work and WPA work, and there's just a lot of that happening in the Black Hills. And I think locally folks are into it and they really get into that history and that archaeology, but a little more broadly it's probably overshadowed by that river basin work. And I would say, like, the eastern half, there's a lot of burial mound sites and a lot of earthwork sites that have had attention in the past from, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s archaeologists, WHO, and those kind of folks. And those got a lot of attention. But in, you know, retrospect, there's a lot that has been overlooked. And I think folks are getting into that now and trying to publish more and do more research and get that out there because it is a treasure trove of archaeology up there, really, just the variety and the time span and all the cultural groups who have been up there. It's a pretty fascinating place to work.
Absolutely. And it also kind of speaks to, like, some of the biases in archaeology, right? Because in Nebraska, the Missouri River is a border, whereas in South Dakota, it cuts straight through. So you have both edges where, like, in Nebraska, the other side of that bank is Iowa territory. And so, like, there's kind of like a difference in who has authority over what and even which archaeologists have authority. And so there's this artificial divide based on geographic boundaries because, like, people lived on both sides of the river and it's kind of treated differently in terms of, like, well, that's the Iowa side. But also, it kind of, you know, which is affected. We look at, like, Northwest Iowa, where Great Oasis archaeology is a big thing. There's, like, Great Oasis sites in Nebraska that haven't been dated until me and Doug did so, and no one's really looked at it. Whereas in South Dakota, right, they have both sides of the river, and they're able to freely look across, and it's under the same authority. So it's, like, interesting in that way, but definitely still cool stuff happening up there. And thinking about Deadwood and the Black Hills. Yeah. it's just really, yeah, I appreciate it. I don't get to South Dakota as much as I wish. And I've only really dabbled on the Missouri River stuff because you have those ancestral Pawnee populations up there for a little bit. And then they come back down into Nebraska and Kansas. And so it's interesting to see how those modern day geopolitical boundaries kind of affect the archaeological record. But
yeah, for sure.
Well, I know we talked a lot about South Dakota archaeology, and you guys are hosting, you guys in Lincoln are hosting the Plains Anthropological Society annual meeting in 2026.
That's
dates
right.
to be announced once the football schedule for the Big Ten has been released.
Yeah.
So we know not to book the same weekend as a football game. So we all have a hotel to stay in. But is there anything for our listeners that you would like to, you know, just say about Nebraska archaeology at the very least?
Well, I'm going to be perfectly honest, I'm going to throw this out here. So I've been here, I think this weekend, it's been 4 years that I've been in this position. So I haven't been here that long out of my, you know, 20 some years doing archaeology. And prior to working here, getting this job, I had never worked in Nebraska before. I'd worked in every state bordering Nebraska at least once, if not multiple times. But going back to what I said, you know, archaeology is archaeology. It's the same folks, it's the same kind of sites, it's the same, you know, type of work. But not having spent a lot of time in Nebraska before being here, it's grown on me so much. It's such a cool state. The culture history here is, you know, I'd say second to none. You know, we've got the sand hills, which are just, I mean, everything I read about the sand hills, every time I go out there, it's like a whole other world. And the archaeology in the sand hills has, you know, we've just touched the very tip of what could be done out there because the way the dunes have moved over the last several millennia. And I think there's a lot more that can be learned out there. And I'm excited to be, you know, getting into that. We finished up a project with KU last December on developing a GIS model for predicting where buried cultural deposits might be located around the state. And it was a three-phase project that I think took, you know, 10 or 12 years to get through fully, but we're getting close to having a public portal for that model to be available, and folks can be able to look and see if the sand hills was the last bit of that. And now we've got a little better idea about how we need to be looking at drainages and landforms in the sand hills to be able to locate archaeological sites. Of course, the more I work with, you know, Matt and Pawnee Nation, just the incredible history of Pawnee Nation in Nebraska and the projects that we've been fortunate enough to work on with you guys, Massacre Canyon and, you know, all the village sites, the lower the Platte and, you know, central Nebraska, eastern Nebraska. It's been a real honor and a privilege to get to work on that archaeology. And can't speak enough about how great it is to work with all you guys from Pawnee Nation. And really, I think the relationships, because of Rob, for all the years he put in here, it's really a pretty easy gig. He set things up so well, and everyone works great together. We have good relationships. We have friendly relationships. We collaborate. We call and email, and I don't know. It's awesome. Nebraska archaeology is great. So, yeah, come to the Plains Conference next year. It's going to be a blast.
It's probably going to be one of the largest ones every time it's in Lincoln. And it used to be in Lincoln over Thanksgiving weekend, so Mary Adair told me. It used to be a big thing. But yeah, for our listeners, if you're interested more about Nebraska archaeology, we'll have some links down below where you can get a hold of Dave in his office. We've interviewed Nolan Johnson, Rob Bozell, and Matt Reed, where me and Matt talk about the Massacre Canyon survey. And so, you know, please go give those goes another listen. We'll have Dave on at another time. Until then, stay tuned, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarchpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.